Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Dorothy Allison, the author of Bastard Out of Carolina, a novel recently published in paperback by Plume Books. And, I want to begin by moving into the oddity of this book, which has been nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award and well regarded. I want, its interest and peculiarity for me is that while the prose takes on the role of honeysuckle dripping, it's very lyrical, country, warm and endearing prose, the subject matter, which is violence and incest and poverty and cruelty, goes against the grain of that and seems to be what makes the book so interesting. Stylistically, was that your intention?
I hadn't thought about it that way. The voice is a voice I've developed. It's the way I write. It's the way I think. It's the music that I hear in my head. And I don't think about the plot of the book in the way you've described of it. I think of it as being about real life, mm-hmm. and that there's a way of looking at real life as if it were song. And that's the way I approached writing the novel. If you've looked at the short stories I do, it's the same approach. I love gorgeous language. Mm-hmm. I love language that just lifts you up out of what's happening to you and lets you see something wider. And also you can get people to listen to things if you're very calculated in how you, if you really entice them with gorgeous language, you can get them to hear stuff they wouldn't otherwise listen to.
Mm. But for instance, I know that you're a fan of Flannery O'Connor,
yes.
for example. And O'Connor worked very hard to get the rolls and southernisms out of her writing. She wrote a very angular and spiky kind of sentence.
Mm.
And when she writes polite, it's usually with malice underneath. I think most famously of the polite sentence, "Would you care to join your son?" said by a killer to the mother, and he's about to shoot her, and he means,
yes.
"Would you care to join him on the ground bleeding?"
And a good man is hard to find.
And a good
yes.
man is hard to find. This is a very different kind of thing. This is almost, you know, a very lulling storyteller's mm-hmm. kind of prose.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it seems to me that it tells you things that you may not want to hear,
mm-hmm.
and it tells you them in a way that makes them intimately understandable.
Huh. It's interesting, because when I teach students and when I work with young writers, one of the things I'm always telling them is that what you're trying to do is cast a spell on your reader, and you're trying to create a piece of work in which nothing will jar the spell. You want them to keep falling deeper and deeper into the story. And that's very deliberately how I write. I hadn't thought so much about it being it is in some ways almost a lullaby.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to lull them into an acceptance of what I think is the real world.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting to me because, you know, it seems to me you've said in a statement that that people who write about incest and family dysfunction write as if there were no pleasures in it, as if it were not something that intrigues and tickles and delights and before
mm-hmm.
it assaults.
Mm-hmm.
And so the prose style does that too. It says, this is how things happen, not with the stark horror of a TV movie, but with the general role of the way a parent talks to you who you're trying to love, who you suspect doesn't love you.
Slow, enticing, seductive. With its real meaning almost hidden until it comes up and really bites you. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Well, that's, you see, I think that any novel that really moves one not because only of its subject matter, but because its subject matter has found a form of prose individual to it. And that's how I describe the individual quality of Bastard Out of Carolina, mm-hmm. that it has a way of making what in other hands is horrific into the daily.
And understandable as much as it's possible. Yeah. That's the idea. You're good. I don't usually get to even talk about writing in the way that you're approaching it.
It seems to me that the reason people only talk about plot when they are interviewed about books is because finding the language for style is a difficult thing to do, but one wants readers to become sensitized to the things that seduce them in a novel.
Well, it's also because it's very, very difficult to talk about finding language for style. It's easy to talk about character and plot. That's building blocks. You can almost outline it and explain it. But to explain how you discover voice and language, because it is such a slow accumulation, is really difficult. And most people don't look at works that way. They don't even know that they're being seduced or that the language is not. When you look at a book, you don't see its language being necessarily different unless it's experimental or very jarringly stylistic. Mm-hmm. When it's designed not to jar and, in fact, to sneak in under your defenses, it's much harder to see.
Now, your heroine Bone develops fairly early on, even before her experience is one of tremendous horror, a fantasy life in which she imagines, for instance, being in a haystack that's burning.
Yes.
This is her first conscious experience of masturbation, but it is also the undertone of the novel. The heroine has an inner life that has accustomed itself and delighted itself by cruelty. Could you talk about that?
Well, not so much even cruelty as danger.
Danger.
And it's the whole, it's that sense that all sexual energy is surrounded by an aura of danger, an aura of threat, and all of her fantasies are constructed in that. When she's very young, the haystack scene is, she orgasms to the dream of fire, and that's where it all begins for her. Later it becomes even more elaborate, and she develops a whole series of fantasies, all of which are still that sense of threat and fear, which is exactly what's happening in her life. But she doesn't ever articulate the fact that she's being sexually abused. So all of her language about what's happening to her body, her emotions, tends to be slightly removed and slightly nonspecific. Her fantasies, however, are where the violence comes in, because that's what she feels, and she knows on that level what's going on.
Well, what interested me about that fire fantasy is because, in a sense, fire is her friend.
Yes.
It's fire that burns down the Hall of Records that contains her birth certificate that lists her as a bastard. All of her mother's resorts to the law won't take those words off her birth certificate. It's only fire that helps her out. And so she comes throughout the book, like her experience of male violence, to see a friendliness or an ally in the violent inner nature of things.
Exactly. There's even a point later in the book when she dreams that, or tells herself she hopes that it all burns, that all of Greenville would just burn to the ground, burn it all. And she's not even thinking of Greenville or Gladys Glenn or the people around her. She wants the world to burn. It's that all-consuming rage. Yes.
Her first sight of a black child her age is of a girl who she thinks might be a boy, and she's attracted to her hardness. And I, of course, thought that this was going to be the introduction of sensuality into her life. I was very impressed by the end of the chapter that they move out of that home and that you didn't take up the immediate opportunity to explore that. Do you think of this as a gay or a lesbian novel?
I think of it as a working class novel by a lesbian writer. And that's how I've talked about it all along. There's a whole undercurrent of sensuality and eroticism in almost all of Bone's relationships with other girls and women. But she doesn't have any concept of, she doesn't have a concept of her own sexual self at that point, not even by the end of the book. All of her sexual self is defensive, which is, makes sense in what's happening to her. But I wanted it there very strongly.
The women in the Boatwright family don't like men, in fact feel contempt for them unless they have some kind of violence. It's the violence that provokes them. They make fun, for instance, of men who are too gentle.
I don't know that I agree. I think that the women in the Boatwright family like men, they just don't expect much of men, which has been was my experience growing up in a working class family. All the women that I knew had to be much more grown up than the men in their lives, and it's kind of a it's a really grief-stricken horrible fact, but most of the men had room to be boys much longer than women had room to be girls. So, and the women are very realistic. They love their men, they just don't think they're very reliable or trustworthy or grown up.
But for instance, I think about Bone's stepfather, Glenn, Daddy Glenn. The women and the men know that his quietness and his awkwardness and his tenderness at the beginning are only acceptable because there's that understratum of wildness of temper and of violence.
But that's male, yes, yes.
And that the women in the family are drawn to men who have this element in them. Now, you see, I guess I'm asking you because I come from a family myself where violence was bleached out, you know. I was raised by a grandmother who was afraid when I was a Boy Scout, a Cub Scout, that I might hurt myself with a knife that I used to carve soap with, you know. I was lied about. My parents signed that I had done the soap sculpture in order for my grandmother to be satisfied that the... So male violence, in a sense, is as foreign and as thrilling, as alien to me as it is to a shock.
But for the Boatwrights, male violence is normal, and an absence of it is not only frightening, they really get... They get not only scared but contemptuous of any man who doesn't have that undercurrent. There's there are twin boys in the book, Gray and Garvey, Bone's cousins, and one of the things that I use them to show is what happens to young boys who don't have that natural instinct for violence. One of the brothers has it and is his father's darling, and is, they're all proud of him. The other is considered a little soft, and they're all kind of nervous about who he's going to be and what he can accomplish. It's not until he actually begins to do that normal thing for normal for them, when he breaks into Woolworths, begins to steal things, becomes that kind of dangerous boy, that they begin to understand him and like him. Before that, they're afraid of him. They don't understand him.
Now, to what extent does Bone grow up to be Dorothy Allison?
Well, I never thought of Bone growing up to be me. I'm kind of curious about who she's going to grow up to be. I used my life to shape her very, very strongly. I put everything into her that I had learned. You see, Bone, I made Bone as a way to figure out, in some ways, how I had survived. But more, I made her as a way to understand why I had never loved myself as a child, why I thought I was a monster. So I made her believing she was a monster. All through the book, she really believes it. And yet I try to construct her in such a way that the reader knows she's not, and that what you're waiting for is for her to begin to realize that she's not a monster. It's a trick almost for me, because as I was writing her, I was thinking about myself as a child and beginning to realize that I wasn't this hateful creature I had thought I was.
The reason I ask is not because I'm interested in what is true or false, but because it seems to me that the hardest thing, and this, unless I'm mistaken, is your first novel,
yes,
is to work autobiographically. And there is some degree of distance in this first book that you don't expect to find. You know what I mean? It seems to me that you've mastered some aspect of childhood, and that made me think perhaps this was experience that had been handled to some extent successfully.
Processed.
Enough. Yes.
Yeah. I think so, but I'm not the age that most people write their first novels. I'm 43 years old, and I've been writing a long time. So I bring to this novel a whole lot more experience in shaping that kind of storytelling than I would have been able to do at 20 or 23.
What were the books that made you say, I'd like to write a book like this? This is the kind of book I'd write if I were writing.
Well, Flannery O'Connor. Oh, Lord, yes. But I never thought of her as being malicious. I thought of her as having an enormous insight and writing always with this great irony and great grief. I just, when I found her, I fell in love with her. The ones I wished I had written, there are too many of them.
Well, you know, one of the things that I liked about this book, I remember that when I was young, before I knew what books to pick for myself, my mother in particular recommended books to me, and they'd be books about people growing up. In particular, I think of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
I read that.
And the quality that I liked about this book is that while it's a literate novel, it's not a literary novel. It manages to do the things that my mother liked for books to do. It tells how character and sensibility and courage got formed, and in some sense, it's an old-fashioned read. You know, you don't find many books like this nowadays, and if you do, they tend not to be as well written as Bastard Out of Carolina is.
You're very charming.
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to be honest.
I absolutely agree that it's an old-fashioned book, or at least an old-fashioned narrative. That's how I write. That's the kind of storytelling I'm most interested in. It's the kind of novels that I get enormous satisfaction out of. I'll tell you, the hard thing to explain is that the book that really made me write this in some ways is Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye.
Well, that makes sense to me.
She did something there that I couldn't find anywhere else. It's horrible to say that I wanted a white girl to do it too, but I did.
Could you say what that was?
She told you a completely harrowing, horrible story in language so beautiful that you were taken into it and you came out of it with a true epiphany. You had seen something larger, understood some greater grief than we are usually allowed to see.
What are you working at now?
Well, unfortunately, I'm working on short stories now. I have been working on a novel, but I've had to take some time away from it just to get some balance back, because my life has been continually interrupted this year, both with having a new baby and with doing all this travel because of the book.
I wondered, you know, it seems to me that you say you're 43 and this is a first book. Life must have changed very distinctly upon the publication, and
yes,
and it's the kind of thing that one dreams of, you know, to be discovered with one's first novel at whatever age, but you have the pleasure of enjoying it, you know, of knowing what's happening to you.
It's kind of strange because it's not what I dreamed of. To be very honest, this is my third book. It's my first novel. I had this notion that I was going to make very sure that this book was successful enough for me to be able to write another one. And I had this vision of about 10 years of work, and I figured that it would take me that long to persuade anyone to really take me seriously. So in some ways, this has been kind of scary. It's like they've jumped me into a category I wasn't prepared to talk in. You understand what I mean?
Well, I do know, because the other day I was at UCLA doing my book gathering, and I ran into two librarians, and they both read the book, and they were both very, very impressed that I'd be talking to Dorothy Allison. You know, and the book had defined something in their own lives for them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess that's why I'm making much of what we're calling for the moment old-fashioned, but rather I think it's a quality that books once had. When you were growing up, they told you you would find a book that you identified with, and maybe if you don't find that book, you turn to other books and you accept other things. But this is the kind of book, if it works for you, that you most search for.
I understand what you're saying. That's kind of scary, but it's exactly in some ways what I intended.
Mm-hmm. Do you find many readers identifying with you?
Oh, absolutely. I've been getting letters, starting with last, I think the first one I got was last May, after I got back from traveling around the country. I get the most extraordinary letters, and they all begin more or less the same way, which is, you told my story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Maine, my family wasn't poor, but you told my story.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm from North Dakota, and I lived on a farm, but this is exactly what I felt. This is what happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
Over and over again, sometimes in 30-page letters, people send me amazing things that they've made. That gets a little scary sometimes, because it has such enormous emotional weight, and I'm having trouble just answering these letters. I'm having trouble knowing what to say, because the book is what I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the things I wanted to say were large and complicated, and they were, to a large extent, about the nature of love and suffering and loss and betrayal. Very big issues.
Well, you know, I often make fun on the show and in life of the idea of a beloved writer, because I often think that a writer should not be beloved, you know, that beloved works are cheating.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't.
You think they should run us down and kick us and chase us and tell us to work harder?
No, not necessarily. I think that books ideally expose us to dangers that we may be relieved not to have found in life.
Yes.
But that their tone is frequently not that of yours has an enthralling quality. And I don't normally, I'm being honest here, I make fun of that, but because this material is so honest and real, I admire it for inspiring love rather than smirk. I think the essence, although it's very fine, of dishonest writing is those early stories of Truman Capote, say, where you get all of that syrup. And, you know, he's doing every writer's trick, you know.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of the story, you want to go and squat and meet that man when he comes out of his apartment. You want to be his best friend. And you know, on some deeper level, as you grow up as a reader, that he's done it on purpose, that he's tricking you, that the stories are not real, that these children are too enchanted, that this is all To Kill a Mockingbird with only the sweet Boo Radley, no more deeper issue. And the tone at first of Bastard Out of Carolina has all that caressing love, but the book goes full circle, and I admired that tremendously.
You're a much harder man than I am. I absolutely believe Truman Capote. I fell in love with Harper Lee. I tracked down Barbara Kingsolver after I read The Bean Trees. I fall in love with books, and I believe the writers intrinsically until they break my heart.
But, do they break your heart?
Well, yeah, a lot of times.
How does that happen?
Well, they do another book that's so startling or so different or fails. When a book fails, it's like I've lost a best friend.
Mm-hmm.
No one.
Have you found a working class readership for this novel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I had the hope that what I'm doing, it's one of the reasons I go around and talk, is that I'm pushing a working class literature. Because we don't have it. And we did. There's been a long tradition of the working class novel. And it's actually become very rare. I think of Barbara Kingsolver as the other contemporary lesbian, well, not lesbian, but contemporary working class novelist.
Oh, that's very interesting, because I think that's absolutely true. And I think, you know, that to some extent, William Carlos Williams and books like White Mule were writing great working class novels, and something happened. You know, it went out of fashion. Well, it might be writers' programs, it might be any number of things, but I don't know how it happened. But the novel, to some extent, went to the university.
To a certain extent, but also traditional narrative did go out of style. We've gone through at least a decade of novels that are just don't work like that. Much more experimental fiction, much more examples of fiction that really break form, in which the narrator keeps stepping in to talk to you on some other level. I can't stand that. I recognize it as a technique. I just don't like it. I like stories. I like stories that you fall into. I also am absolutely in love with the idea of literature as redemption. You know, I don't have much in the way of religion, but I believe that you can go into really good literature and see large truths and learn new things, and that people will believe you.
What is it you're trying to redeem?
I think mostly, I am redeeming myself. Now, along the way, I believe in the audience, and I believe in the reader. And that if you have any kind of voice at all, you can give them a way to see the thing that they also know and believe. You tell the truth. It's like everything, when I was working on the novel, the check on everything that I wrote was, is this real? You know, and there were places where I would go slightly off and I'd look at it and no, that would not really happen. And I'd have to cut it no matter how beautiful it was.
Now, I do believe that a novel allows the reader another way to live.
Yeah.
You know, lets life go on no matter who you are. You know?
Well, it can also convince people that certain kinds of people and things happen, that families like the Boatwrights exist, even though there's only a cliched idea of that kind of working class family in the popular imagination now. I mean, I knew exactly what I was doing in making them, and I wanted to make it possible for them to be taken seriously as themselves rather than some sociological idea in hackneyed language. I hate that.
I hate it, too. I've been talking to Dorothy Allison, the author of Bastard Out of Carolina, just recently published in paperback by Plume Books. Thank you, Dorothy, for coming and talking.
Thanks.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, books, books. Too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.